Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, what's up? Chad Wesley Smith here. We are at the Max's Gym in Oakland, California. Not to be confused with Imposter Max's Gym across the world, like in Hawaii. It's different. Don't confuse them.
Max'sGym.net.
It is. joined as always by magnanimous Max Montana. Right. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing pretty well.
And our guest today, Mr. Joel Smith. Joel is a strength and conditioning coach for the University of California Golden Bears, right up the road, as well as a contributor some to JTSstrength.com. Got a few articles on there. So I guess, well, before we get into that, today's episode is brought to you by Single Leg Bounds and Coffee Grounds. It's a lifestyle. And just tell us a little bit about your athletic background and how you got into collegiate strength and conditioning.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of like we were talking for just a few minutes before, I'm kind of like a one percenter. I originally, when I was in graduate school at Wisconsin La Crosse in applied sports sciences, I told my advisor, I'm either going to be a track coach or a strength coach. I'm not sure. And he's like, well, you kind of have to make a decision. Like, you're kind of getting to that point. And so I was interning in the weight room, and I was helping out as a volunteer with the track program. And after a little bit, I'm like, you know, I think I want to do track and field. Just because it's like, I think similar to weightlifting, it's like a pure sport. That's the only thing you're training for. For me at the time, that was the main direction I wanted to go. And then I wanted to still do S&C with track being the primary. And so I did that. I ended up coaching as a grad volunteer assistant for 2 years. I was a full-time track and field coach at a place called Wilmington College for 4 years. And towards the end of my time there, I was doing S&C for some of the teams, basketball, football, baseball. I was kind of almost the intern coordinator there in a way. Like, there'd be interns, and I would help them make programs, and they would run the programs. But I was kind of heading that up. So I still had my foot in the S&C door, and even as a track coach, I always wanted that. At the end of the day, kind of I think the thing that has defined me is the only thing that matters is your performance. So it's, you know, how fast did you sprint, relevant to your sport? Could you jump relevant to your sport? Can you move well? And so, yeah, from there, I had a quantum leap of sorts going from kind of hillbilly land, a Division III school with 1,200 kids, to UC Berkeley as a strength coach for track. So it was like almost a specialty role. It was kind of like, okay, here's a track guy who does strength. Well, track and field, strength conditioning, here we go. So I did that, and then
Let's, before we get into this next part, kind of expand on that idea, what we were just talking about before we recorded. Should we always do that? I should never talk to anyone before we record, because that's always the best stuff.
It's like golden, yeah.
But that unique situation that track and field tends to be in of, you know, so much more integration between sport practice and weight room training. You talk about this, sort of why that's so important to track, and maybe how some other sports could learn from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Cal Dietz says it good too. Like, if you're in like college strength and conditioning, you should work with track and swimming at some point. And I think it's good, because if you are in track and field and you're a strength coach for track and field, it is interesting too. There's a lot of times in a lot of colleges, the track job is like kind of the last on the totem pole, and you start there and you work your way up or things like that. But it's a tremendous opportunity, because you get to find out very quickly if what you're doing is contributing or not contributing. Like, you know, if you took someone's squat max from 400 to 500, but they didn't run faster, or maybe they even ran slower. And there's always different reasons too. It's never, in my experience, it's never one thing. Like, it's never, you know, I just pinned it. And sometimes it's like, oh, I pinned it on this lift or this, but it's never one thing. But you learn very fast if you're only looking at the results. And that is a prereq. Like, if you're the strength coach for a track or swimming or an individual sport, like, you almost have to look at what the kids are doing at every meet and even the big practices more than your record board in the weight room.
Yeah, because it's a pure output.
And right.
I think it's why track tends to be at the forefront of training concepts, is it's a pure output sport. It's the fastest, highest, farthest, you know, most powerful in the throwers. And it doesn't get, you know, the training doesn't get muddied so much by like strategy. You know, there's not a ton of strategy to a 100-meter sprint. Like, I'm going to go as fast as I can in the start, and then
mostly
as fast as I can the rest of the time, too. You know, so you just get that pure, this is what we did in the weight room, and this is how it corresponded to sporting success, where, you know, football, basketball, all the strategy and other technical, wider variety of technical skills may not let them express their general physical improvements from the weight room.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you could make your team the leanest, meanest, strongest, but, you know, if they go turn the ball over, it's like,
yeah.
I guess it's like, well, that's not me. But I mean, it's I want to always be as invested as I can with whatever I'm working with. I'm a very like a very thorough person. Like, I want to do everything I think I could possibly do to help the team win. That's ultimately my goal, is trying to at least impact that as much as I can. I think that's where the field's headed in many ways, trying to find different ways to accomplish that.
And what are the, so you work with track and field now, still working with swimming?
My journey kind of started with track and field, did that for three and a half years, and then I transitioned to doing mostly aquatics, so men's, women's swimming the last two and a half years, and then men's tennis is my land sport I'm still with, but it's been just same thing, but different medium. So in swimming, it's like a Bizarro, you know, Superman Bizarro, or was it the Seinfeld Bizarro universe, where they have the characters that are in a different life.
Yeah, yeah.
Swimming is like everything that makes you good at track makes you a horrendous swimmer, yeah, and vice versa. Like,
yeah, totally opposite body types. I have, like, swimmers, and Cal swimming, men's and women's, incredibly, you know, successful programs and Olympians and all that stuff. But you get this great swimming body, has super broad shoulders and narrow hips, and, you know, no ass and short legs. And I've described, yeah, when I used to work with a lot of swimmers and water polo players, described them as land retarded. You know, you put them in water and they're egg beating out, and they're fast and coordinated and smooth. And then you watch them try and do like high knees, and like, are you having a seizure right now, or are you running? So I definitely feel you there.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. It's been awesome, because at the same time you almost get to track is almost like there's a lot of little peripheral things you look at, like, I don't know, ankle strength or hamstrings or little things on the outside that you think might be able to fit or you piece into the total equation. Swimming, I mean, it's the land, it's the water. Its hydrodynamics is so different than anything you could hope to make there's always, you know, different ideas, but it's really forced me to focus on just almost like the general, like, neurotransmitter types, like dopamine sensitivity. Am I charging your neural battery with this weight session, or am I taking away from it? Did I, and just keeping as simple as, what's the effect of this barbell program on this athlete's nervous system? Am I giving this guy too much barbell work in the week, and he's not able to fully utilize his, you know, abilities in the water? And so it makes me look even closer on what transfers.
How is the, like, culturally, because, like, you talked about track and field and strength and conditioning, oftentimes sport coach is also the physical preparation coach, whereas, like, football, it's almost entirely separated. It's really rare that you'd have, maybe even never have, like, a head football coach is also the strength and conditioning coach. How is that in the aquatic sports? Is it similar, or?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it just kind of depends on the coach. Like, as far as my experience with different track coaches and different swim coaches, everyone's a little bit individual. And when I was in, like, track and field, there were some coaches who were like, here's the program, you know, go do it. And so far my experience with aquatic coaches is they very much let you have the program. They kind of tell you what they want at the different times. Some of them, they'll tell you, okay, this individual athlete responds like this, and we tend to see this in the water, so maybe let's look at this in the weight room. But so far, at least here in the United States, I don't know what it's like in Europe or anything like that, but it's still very fairly disconnected.
Right.
I mean, there's some aquatic coaches that do the whole thing, but I think the generality is that they usually don't.
Yeah, I found, you know, swimming and water polo to not have much of a dry land training culture or a weight room culture. Maybe the swimming, they, you know, let's say, oh, we have dry land this morning, and they're out there doing push-ups and lunges on the pool deck. Mm-hmm. And the water polo players, it was like a totally foreign thing to them coming in the weight room. And I mean, as successful as Cal's water polo team is, a little bit different, I'm sure. But breaking that barrier and kind of getting those athletes to buy into it, I So that was a big challenge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and some athletes, especially in the aquatic world, but even in track, some athletes are just, like, very against the weight room. And, you know, it's kind of, sometimes you're almost, if the athlete's swimming fast and they don't like the weight room, there's not necessarily a lot of point in saying, you must lift this, like, to be good. It's more like, look, here's some little ways I can make you better with a minimum dose. And let's start here and, you know, just do good movement and let's see what happens. So, but you're right, there's definitely some mentalities where it's, you can be, you know, not that excited about that, especially if you're a water animal.
Yeah. So when we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Joel more about transfer of weight room to, you know, track and field, speed, jumping ability, his specialty, his website, justflysports.com. And so we'll be back on The Jug Life with Joel Smith. All right, we are back on The Jug Life podcast with University of California strength and conditioning coach Joel Smith. And I want to get into a bit of Joel's specialty. You can check out his website, justflysports.com. And as you may have guessed from the name, a big emphasis of it is improving, you know, jumping and explosive power. So what we want to talk about now is sort of how the weight room can be and also, you know, can help, and in many cases maybe can actually inhibit an athlete's ability to jump higher, jump farther, run faster. So maybe let's start out with whatever you really want to start with. But how does the weight room, how is it important to improving those qualities?
Yeah, so I'm glad you started with like how it's important, because I don't want to come here and be the bad guy. I'm like, I'm on this podcast, weightlifting sucks. No, I mean, I have gone to enough track and field conferences where you actually get those people who come out. They're like, my kids, and they run fast. I mean, you know, but I do think ultimately weightlifting when done correctly is an awesome help to athletes. I think it's more like the subtleties of it, like the subtle differences in, and maybe it's a way like
don't, listeners, don't glaze over the part where you said when done correctly. We're not just talking about it from a technique standpoint, but the context of what we're aiming here for at speed and power development.
Yeah, no, totally. That's a good point too. I mean, it's the total package. It's the pattern of the lift itself, and then it's the dosage, and that dosage is individual too. Yeah. Some athletes can have like some football players or track athletes actually really feed off of really heavy weights done in the correct dose, whereas some, if you give them too much work, their nervous system gets burned out. I don't like to use that term, but some of them do better with alternative means being the primary. One of the things that really got me thinking, at least in terms of, what's that point where, what is too strong, right? Like, if I squat 400, will going to 500 help me jump higher? And it was, I can't remember the name of the book. It was, I think, an Egyptian guy. You guys would probably know, Olympic weightlifting book. And he had talked about, it's almost like there was a point, if you're an Olympic lifter, where having a deadlift that was too good would start to inhibit your Olympic lifting, because your upper back would start to get into a little kyphosis to make that shorter lever arm to be an awesome deadlifter. And so I'm like, okay, maybe there's these morphological changes that are associated with. And I occasionally see, when I see a kid, usually it would be more of a track kid than swimming, because swimming kids don't grow up like living in the weight room. Some track kids do. And you may see some signs, like their spine, you can almost tell that they were doing a lot of heavy weightlifting. And they may be very good, but those little changes in their spine may be inhibiting them from that last like 2 or 3% or something like that. So I think it's not, as long as your program is balanced, it's not a huge thing. Like, it's not gonna, I've gone in this own personal pendulum where I think I read Easy Strength, Dan, John, and Pavel, and then a few other things, I'm like, okay, and Bondarchuk, you know, don't go above 80% and all this stuff, and I'm like, okay, my athletes should never go above 80%, but I've kind of swung back a little bit. I'm like, some athletes really feed off of going above 80%, and so it's very individualized, but generally weightlifting, and I've kind of classified this in a big project book I'm working on, it's almost like, instead of a one rep max, rewriting what the lift brackets do for athletic performance. And on the low level, there's motor learning and muscular coordination. And there's actually research that's like, it's just with finger flexors, but just doing finger strength training actually improve people's like motor tasks. So just being a more coordinated athlete. And that would come out of like the 1x20 system, Dr. Yesus. And a few of my contacts who are really getting into that, they'll do like 25 exercises, just one set of 20 and then 14, but it's like every joint motion you can imagine for young athletes, like age 12 to 18. And the big benefit is coordination. Like the athletes are just getting, they have better control of their joints. They can generally produce better force or get more of what their muscles already have to offer in a variety of motions. And so I think that's one way, like a very base level, young athlete level way of looking at it. And I feel like some athletes can almost stop there. Like the next level would be potentiation. And that would be using a heavy weight, like 80 plus, 80, 90 plus, or 80 move really fast to get as many motor units activated as you can. And then you take that and then you put it into your skill. If you don't put it into your skill, you're kind of wasting it, like, because it's different skills, right? You have to pair the two some way, whether it's doing complex training in the session, so I lift a heavy weight and I do a jump, or it's, say, I lifted a really heavy weight and then 2 days later I had my quarterfinal of the 100-meter dash or something like that. It just depends on the athlete a little bit on exactly what the specs are.
As you look at, you know, there's so many different types of athletes out there, but if we were to sort of classify track and field athletes, sprinters and jumpers, into two main categories, I would see that as more of like your power sprinter, like think a Dwayne Chambers, Maurice Greene, very muscular, and then more of a reactive elastic type of athlete, longer, thinner, you know, generally a bad weight room build.
Sorry, if you didn't know, yeah.
And do you find that to be a big distinction on how they respond to training?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And so I'll use myself as an example. I don't like to use myself because it's like, obviously you want to have athletes you're talking about, and I have plenty of examples from athletes. But Christian Thibodeau's neurotyping system has almost put a tag on exactly what you're talking about, to the point where with swimmers, it's like, well, I don't really know if you're good at plyometrics or not because this isn't your thing, you know?
Right. Like, yeah.
But even being able to say, okay, you're a stretch shortening person, you're more of a max intensity person. And so Christian would call like the max intensity person like the 1A. That would be like the Mo Green, the Ben Johnson, the guy who can squat 600. And I think it was sprint coach Ryan Banta who told me, he called up Ben Johnson and said, did you or did you not like squat the week that you did that world record? And he's like, yeah, I squatted like 600 3 days before I ran or something like that. Like that would be the type 1A.
Right.
They can lift a heavy weight and use it and go do their thing. The 1B is someone who's a little bit more of a plyometric athlete. They can still lift heavy weights. I mean, my best high jump meet in college, well, I had two best meets. My first one, I had done a PR in a box back squat, like two-thirds of the way down because my build isn't great for deep squats, 3 days before.
I want to touch on that, too, in a second, squat depth and training, but keep going.
Oh, yeah, cool. And that's also something I've definitely really been interested in over the years. And so I did that. I set that, like, personal PR for a triple. 3 days later, I had the best. I set, like, a four-foot PR in triple jump. My skill was horrendous, but it was, like, I was just, like, lightning. Like, it was crazy. And then high jump, I made my best crack at 7 foot I had ever made, and it was like I was just on fire that meet. And then 2 months later, we had a meet. We traveled down to Emory University in Georgia, and I had done a depth jump workout, like a pretty tough depth jump workout, like from boxes like this high, 4 feet. I don't know, there's 4 feet. But 3 days before, again, and I set my PR 7 feet, and I was like, you know, but if I wouldn't have done that workout, I don't think I could have done that, but if you look at Christian Thibodeau's neurotyping, the 1B, and I'm an elastic guy to the ends of the earth, but novelty is important. So almost the type, the way they're stimulated and the way they're potentiated can change. I think for me, maybe it just needed to change. Someone like Ben Johnson or Mo Green probably wouldn't do very good to do depth jumps 3 days before. They're more of a strength and intensity muscle contraction type guy.
Right.
So we started talking about it a little bit, and I see it debated all the time, and I've kind of gone through different phases of thinking about it in terms of, you know, sport performance. But obviously in our world, powerlifting, weightlifting, you got to squat to competition depth and you got to squat to the end of your range of motion. So, you know, our fans and a lot of our listeners are probably seeing videos of some track athletes out there. You know, if you see a video of Usain Bolt lifting weights, he's really fucking bad at it. Like, but he's really good at what matters for him, running incredibly fast. So squat depth, quarter squats, because even the word coming up in track and field and reading articles, you know, from European coaches and Russian coaches and everything, you see something like, you know, squat 400 for five, Udo Beyer squat 400 for five, and squat to a track coach can mean like so many different things.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
They say half squat, and some coaches say half squat is halfway to parallel. Other coaches say half squat is halfway down, which like would be too parallel. And so what are you seeing with, you know, what's the best kind of squat? How deep should athletes be squatting?
Oh yeah, no, that's an awesome question. It's been a huge area of interest for mine. And for me, this was just me growing up. I kind of was my own almost research project for years. Like I had come to this conclusion as a young athlete that deep squats were good in the off season, but as soon as you want to be sharp and explosive, you have to do half squats or quarters or something that's not deep. And what I find is for elastic athletes, that tends to be the case. I think if you're a more of a muscle driven athlete, you know, fulls is fine, but it does depend a little bit on your sport. So going to the research a little bit, I'm really bad at remembering exactly what. But there's been a few like key landmark studies, and people tend to hang their hat on the study that fits with what they like.
Yeah, yeah.
If there's a study that says full squats were the best, oh, that's the study. And yeah. If there's a study that says quarter squats are the best, well, let's start doing this. And a happy medium that I think I've found is if an athlete meets a basic strength standard, there was one that was done recently that showed that quarter squats were the best in jumping and sprinting transfer, but you had to have a 1.5 back squat base, and probably some of the people were higher than that. And that's not that high, but I've come to realize I don't think the base is actually that high for deep squats. Like, I'm like a 1.5, 1.75 guy, and beyond that, it's your sport. Like,
yeah, it's right, right. 1.5 to 1.7 times body weight is what it means.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. yeah, totally. And so someone had forwarded me, it was the study design is so huge in that stuff. Like, someone had talked to me, because I was like, hey, I was talking with a coach, like, what do you think about the study that had shown that quarter squats were better if you were 1.5. And they're also in that program. They had, you know, a group do quarters and a group do halves and a group do fulls. But they also had other full range of motion exercises in the program, which I think is very important. I think in terms of just general strength, it is important to be maintaining like a long muscle length, because you could look at it from a quarter squat is a compensatory motion because it doesn't utilize the full rubber band motion. It's just potentiation, pure and simple. Mm-hmm. And so there was a Schmidt-Bleicher, I think is his name, German guy study where they did, it showed that, well, untrained people, subjects, maybe like a year, but they did deep front, deep back, and quarter squats. And the quarter squat people got fried. I mean, they didn't jump higher. Their rate of force development went down. But you're taking these guys to the limit, untrained, three times a week, quarter squats, which is highly neural. You're going to be smoked for like a month after that. You're not going to be able to do anything. So it's just study design.
Yeah, the study design on that stuff, it is so, there's so many variables that they can't account for, really. And so when you're reading those studies, like the even grouping the athletes into the full squat group and the half squat group, and then we're talking about the different, you know, athlete types and muscle fiber and body types and how that relates to it. Well, if they got put in the wrong one or the right one, it's going to hugely influence the result.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I was trying to find the name of the study. It was bouncing around Instagram. I don't use Instagram to get my information generally, but every now and then something interesting pops up. And it was a study that came out last year. And there was one group that did both groups did a strength block, so above 80%, I believe, and then they did a speed block, like 55-60% of barbell training, and they found about half the people were strength responsive. I think they tested RFD every day, like a put your leg in the you know, isokinetic and just go as fast as you can, and they just, because that kind of tells you that quick speed strength, that if as soon as you start to overtrain your nervous system, or if your brain and body doesn't like the training, you will see RFD drop. And there was a group, about half the people did really well on the max strength, and the power was kind of nominal, and the other group was flip-flop. So half of the group were awesome, the heavy strength, half of the group did really well with more of the speed. Where I see that is kind of how you mentioned, like an elastic athlete versus a Usain Bolt being an elastic guy versus a Ben Johnson or a Mo Green or a Dwayne Chambers. And so,
even in that training group, probably Usain Bolt versus Johan Blake.
Yeah, totally.
Very, very different athletes, maybe same coach, same country, all that kind of thing, but we're going to respond to much different training.
Yeah, and it's as soon as I saw that, and going through some of the neurotyping stuff, I kind of seen it coming. But like when you see coaches typically peak athletes, at least in sport or track or swimming, a lot of times the paradigm is, oh, we're going to peak now, so go light and fast. But
Right. Wait,
what about all those people that were strength respondent? You know, Yeah. Like you're kind of screwing them over a little bit. Like,
so I have a question. What do you, knowing that you have these archetypes or different you know categories for people or different types, what is your process when you say get a new group of athletes to sort of establish that? I mean, obviously, just going through training process and competition, you'll start to figure it out. But do you have a faster way of sort of assessing these things?
Oh, no, that's an awesome question. And so I'll start with my swim group because that's like the hardest group to figure out
Right. Sometimes
outside of their actual events. I mean, track, it's like, or even football or basketball. I mean, basketball, you see the shooting guard who's like 6'6", you know, 190, can jump out of the gym. Yeah, I think I know what type you are,
right,
you
right.
know. Or a football, the running back, the short, you know, the short, stocky running back. So with swim, usually, like, I'll start with their event. Are you a sprinter, mid, or distance? That usually gives me a pretty good idea of where at least our starting point is. So within Kristen Thibodeau's neurotyping system, you look at, like, almost personality traits, which is really cool. The strong nervous system tends to come with almost like these kind of dominant traits, like they're gonna like try to crush your handshake a little bit. They're gonna like be really good at like, they're gonna almost try to stare you down with eye contact a little bit.
Don't break eye contact now.
Jack Clark.
Yeah, so there's like these subtleties of personality.
Right.
A lot of times too, the real neural types, like if you put them in the weight room, they're gonna gravitate towards what they love. So a neural athlete like a Ben Johnson type is going to want to put a lot more plates on the bar. You might say, hey, 300 is the limit today, and you're going to turn around and you're going to catch them putting, you know, 375 on the bar. Because for them to get their dopamine fix, they have to. Like, otherwise they get bored. They're like, coach, what am I doing this for? I can do way more than this. Like, come on. Like, and so usually that's kind of a little bit of a giveaway. And then also, to me, and then outside of that and just those general personality, the race distance is the biggest one, for sure. But even, and then personality a little bit. And then beyond that, what was I trying to say? I kind of got so carried away, I lost myself a little bit. Just like general response, so meet, looking at, well, what's our phase, and then how did this guy do? And obviously, again, there's, or girl, and there's a lot of factors at play, but if we're doing like a strength phase, mm-hmm. and someone's just getting noticeably below maybe where the rest of the athletes are at, or a few people are, I'll say, okay. And what I did this year with my swim groups that I do think worked well is I took a couple guys out of the mid-distance group that I felt like their nervous system was just getting blasted by doing the mid-distance stuff, and I put them in the distance group, which is more like almost circuits and more body weight oriented, and they actually had awesome years. They did way better. Huh. And it's crazy to say, like, it's counterintuitive. As a strength coach, well, I want to get you strong. Yeah. Well, I actually was totally stoked that those guys swam faster. Like, that's what they needed. And just because the barbell volume was just a little too much for them. They needed something that was a little easier.
Yeah, that's interesting because I feel like we see the same kind of thing, at least probably in powerlifting and weightlifting. They're a little bit different because, you know, like you said, different personalities may just gravitate to that. I mean, you're going to have people that come into powerlifting or weightlifting that, you know, enjoy lifting weights, right? But it is interesting because you see sometimes people's best lifting performances in weightlifting come right on the tail end of the largest volume of heaviest training, and moving into peaking periods, they actually lose fitness really, really quickly when any of that volume is taken away. And so it's interesting because, as you say that, because the personality stuff also, in my mind, coincides with that. So it's kind of cool to hear that, you know, there's something backing that up, at least, or in your opinion.
Yeah, I love that you said that, too. I'm just, like, some of my swimmers instantly come to mind as soon as you say that. So same across the world.
So I want to come back a little bit to the squat depth discussion because I felt like we only, I think, got about halfway through it.
We cut it short.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
So early you were off season full squat depth. You know, as they get more into the competition and championship season, they'd have to be doing you know, quarter squats, half squats, whatever. Has your thinking with that changed at all?
Yeah, so the way I kind of generally do it, I'm actually not a big heavy quarter squat guy at all. I mean, I get it, but so if it's a track jumper, I'd rather them get it through plyometrics. I mean, granted, that is more stretch shortening. I feel like it's almost like the Jay Schrader kind of mentality. I've been talking a lot to those types of coaches lately, and it's kind of either do a deep squat full range thing or do a depth jump where it's just like quarter squat, there's your quarter squat there. And starting there before you put 1,000 pounds on some guy's back, because I mean, it's big time spinal loading. For my position as a university strength coach, I really don't want to put 800 pounds on, well, swimmer's back, but even track, like I'm not going to load up your spine yet. And plus two, if it's an athlete, I feel like too, that stuff is almost like, it's almost like nitrous oxide in a way. Like you don't want to use it that like right away. You want to save it for down the line. And when you do it, be strategic. It's like kind of the ace card. When I do it, I actually like doing just holds. So just like drop, maybe, you know, put a heavy weight in the rack, put the safeties up, drop down to a quarter depth, hold it for 5 seconds, and then put it back up. So you kind of eliminate some of the, you know, that spine kind of getting crunched by weight that maybe you're sure as hell not going to squat the deep, you know. So I just felt like, and isometrics are cool because they actually give you about 5% more of that motor pool. Like, I don't know, a quarter squat, if you went up and down, you might get 90% of your fibers. The iso will give you 95%. And so, I mean, that's all I want. So I like doing that in the context of French contrast. If I'm going to do it, that's what I do. I don't do like the actual quarter squats. If I am going to squat, if we do partials, it's usually, I call it a 2/3. I don't really like doing anything half and above. It just doesn't sit that well with me. And I've never really needed it in context of, at least with track, being able to do plyometrics and those types of things. So if it's swim, we'll usually go to like a box, maybe a little higher than this. So it's like just a little below 90. It's not... That's usually the range too, where a lot of athletes' compensations aren't in play too, because once you get below there, especially with swimmers, things can get a little wonky, and so it just allows them to be a little more confident in a range I like. They can be faster with the bar, so I tend to go deep 2/3, and then the quarter stuff I leave to either plyos or like an iso type movement.
So we've talked some about the ways that the weight room can help enhance that. What are common mistakes you see getting made by people trying to get athletes, you know, faster, jumping higher, jumping further, ways they're maybe misusing the weight room towards that goal?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the simplest one would be living in the weight room and not doing, you know, sprinting or not doing jumping is definitely the main one. I mean, most people will say, oh, this study said this. Like hip thrust is a big one, you know, the hip thrust studies. Does the barbell hip thrust make you faster? There's a study with 14-year-olds that says it does. There's two college-age ones that says it doesn't.
Lots of things make you faster when you're really slow.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but the college ones, it's like they weren't sprinting. And you know, when I was full-time track and field, it seemed like the hip thrusts were helping when we did it in balance with everything else. So I think, but at the flip end of that, I will say, I do think for short periods of time when you are stuck and you can't do any speed and you're doing like somewhat specific stuff in the weight room, like fast Russian lunges back and forth as fast as possible, Olympic lift velocity tagged as fast as you can, not as fast as you can, but within a reasonable speed, I think for a short period of time, it's good to let the motor pathways of running rest while you give the body something else, and then you get back to it, and a lot of times you PR. But if you just lived in the weight room for, you know, if you're a football player and you are done with football and say, instead of running track, I'm going to lift weights all spring and I just lift weights for 3 months, you're not going to come out of that, I think. I mean, you're high school, so you're always going to get better, but it would be better for you speed-wise if you ran track than just sitting in the weight room and living there for 3 months.
Right.
And just relying too much on that, especially to, this will be my second point, is the patterning of the movement. I noticed in my time as a strength coach, you would get two kinds of kids. The kids that you could tell lifted a lot coming up in high school, the sprinters and jumpers, and the kids who didn't. And almost without exception, the kids who really didn't lift tended to be a lot more, they had better feet, I would call it. Like, they really could just get to their big toe. They were like kind of like more springy off their toe. And the kids who lived in the weight room just generally just seemed to be a little bit more heel heavy. I think that's just from being told to squat through their heels, sit your butt back in extension over and over and over again. And again, it's not like, I don't think it was a huge difference, but I do think if those athletes were brought up in a little bit better pattern, it's just a subtlety, I think that would have been a little bit better.
Yeah, and in a sport of hundredths of a second and centimeters, a little difference is a big difference.
Yeah, I agree.
When I look at the sprint training I've done with football guys and stuff, is the volume is so much different than what we're commonly dealing with in powerlifting and weightlifting. We were talking about some of the squat workouts that I'd done before, things like, you know, 7 sets of 5, 8 sets of 6, 8 sets of 8, particularly in farther general phases. But I'd have these football guys, and we'd be out on the field, you know, sprints, jumps for distance, med ball throws, and come in the weight room and, you know, 2 or 3 sets of 4 to 6 reps in the squat, very small workouts. Is that something you see people maybe getting over volumized in the weight room and losing some speed with that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So that's the nail on the head. Is everything is good to a point, right? And so I think there's also something, I guess, bad about everything. I was just doing a podcast with Dan Fichter, a guy, a really neurology-based trainer out of New York, and you can find something wrong with literally everything you do. Like, you can look at a squat and say, well, this is going to make you worse, or a deadlift, or a depth jump, and say, you know, I even see track athletes occasionally who are really good at plyometrics, but then not quite as good at their actual event. And there's even, they need to stop doing so many plyometrics. There's something wrong with everything.
Right.
And I mean, I guess you could say, so it is the volume, like you said. I mean, that's a good volume when you're getting to the point. And I can give a good, you know, personal anecdote. Well, a couple. One, my workouts were never huge volume when I was a track coach. We would spend 25 minutes in the weight room after practice, like not really an hour, but I would, I remember my first big paradigm shift in maybe I'm not approaching this the correct way in terms of the weight room and track speed is I got a pretty good 400 runner girl. She was a big recruit for us, a little Division III school. And, you know, she comes in and she might have a max back squat of 155. And by Christmas, so September, she comes in, maybe 155. She's up to 225 for a few reps by December. I'm like, oh, she's going to do awesome this year. She had a terrible year. She ran way slower. We weren't necessarily doing a lot more volume, but just the way the patterning, like looking back, it was a very like kind of sit back, get an extension. Like, it wasn't a good squat for one. Two, she was just she was an elastic kid. Like, I should have probably been giving her maybe half of the volume that I did. She probably needed to run a little bit more than I had her doing. You know, I needed to find things different ways. And so that was the first time I really realized, holy cow, that can make someone slower. Had the same experience with another kid the next year. He got his squat up to, you know, at 170 a rail, like deep squat 335 within only a few months, got his standing vertical up like 3 inches, 4 inches to 37 inches. And then he went out and ran the 200 slower than he did the year before.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, like, it's, so it's just learning to balance things.
Yeah.
You know, it's
you feel like there's it's like a cultural thing because where people might see, oh, you know, it's the, a little bit is good, a lot is better. And maybe they see, well, if the squat came up 30 or 40 pounds, but then in the pursuit of that, they lose focus of specificity or transference in pursuing a big squat. And it's not that their squat comes up as a symptom of the training they're doing, right? So that, you know, you do your track training, you do all these things, in that the organism itself becomes more powerful and stronger, and then your squat is just, you know, higher. Rather than saying, okay, we're going to spend 6 weeks of really intense high volume squat training, those two results come about from very different means.
Yeah.
It seems like there's a cultural thing where we just think we can shortcut it and, oh, we'll just, you know, do a squat program and you end up, you know, stronger, and then therefore you're going to be better.
That's right on. And that kid actually, too, part of the reason he didn't do as well is he was shorting on his like speed endurance workouts. And so his elastic component was not being addressed. His strength component was awesome. And for football, actually, he might have been just fine.
Right,
you know, for running 100 and 200, it fell off at the end. But
I think
totally.
We see that kind of thing in weightlifting a lot, where, and we talk about this too, you know, the kind of training I did when I was younger, there's almost like a, there's so much energy and devoted to the development of strength, or particularly the squat, that, you know, the hope is that my squat goes up 50 kilos, my lifts are going to come with. And in fact, it's almost always the other way around. People bring their squats way up and the results of weightlifting, and we're talking a sport that is heavily, heavily dependent on absolute strength, those numbers come back down, right? I mean, they become worse lifters because they lose some speed component and technique becomes worse. So it's funny to see in that, it's obvious to us in a sport where it seems like it would make a ton of sense that in track, people would kind of pursue that, you know, and end up, right? I mean, it's so much different, right? Squatting versus running, right?
I think where people get caught up in it, and this was definitely me in my own track career throwing the shot put, is you get a huge return from that and a high transfer and high dynamic correspondence early in your career, and then you get better and better, and it stops giving the same carryover.
Yeah.
But, you know, you think, well, when I was a junior in high school, my bench went up 50 pounds and I threw 2 meters further in the shot put. Why isn't that happening when I'm a junior in college? Well, because, you know, you're general skills are high enough now, and you had to bring the special skills up to match it, and that's just not the special skill anymore. Yeah. So kind of last thought I want to get into is going the other way now, taking track and field based training plyometrics and their potential to affect maximal strength. Do you see jumps, step jumps, or different jumping variations being a viable tool for powerlifters and weightlifters to use?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think it just depends on the type of powerlifter, weightlifter. And this is something where I don't have as much, because I don't spend time in, I mean, I wish I spent more time in gyms like this. It'd be awesome. I always try to learn as much as I can. And I always admit when I can't, I'm just speculating. I do know for the sake of track and field, an elastic track and field athlete, my high jumpers that I've worked with throughout the years is back at Wilmington College, myself, I am stronger pound for pound in the squat. It's not a great squat, but I'm stronger pound for pound when I'm doing jump training and track training than if I'm doing a powerlifting program. Maybe I just was doing the wrong powerlifting program, but that's always been the case. Pound for pound, whenever I do powerlifting, my lifts go up, but I also get heavier to the point where my squat to body weight or whatever is not as good as if I'm out doing jumps or whatnot. So I think that it just depends on the type of person. In the neurotyping system, which I'm becoming more accustomed to, I think there is something there. If you're an elastic person and you have, if you're an elastic person, it means you're high in acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is like memory, creativity, someone who likes multitasking is kind of the basic ways to spot that. And they have good stretch shortening. If you can do a depth jump and look good, well, shoot, maybe it will help you out. If you don't look good doing it, what's happening is your nervous system has to work so damn hard to pull that depth jump off, it's going to smoke you after you do it enough times. So
I think that's a big takeaway with any of that type of training is it's extremely potent.
Yeah.
Like volume of depth jumps isn't going to look like volume of snatches, clean and jerks, front squats, pulls, because it's such a huge neural input to the athlete. So if it is something, and it's something that I've used successfully in my powerlifting career, I would go through basically three different phases in meet preparation. In the first block of training, I would do seated box jumps wearing a weighted vest. And I do that for 3 weeks to escalate in higher boxes. Then I'd deload, I would come back, and I would do standing unweighted box jumps for 3 weeks. And then the last 3 weeks, I would do depth jumps. And I have a pretty big history. I did track and field since I was 8 years old. I was a sprinter for a long time. So even though I was 23 and I weighed 300 pounds, most 300-pound powerlifters would not be well-served to do this. I'm just giving you the example. I did like two sets of five depth jumps from 12 inches, then the next week two sets of four from 18 inches, then two sets of three from 24 inches. That's six jumps. I did six jumps was the whole workout. It's not this big volume, and it has a very temporal effect. If I would have added a fourth week to that, maybe I'm too overreached with that. Fifth week, definitely, I'm done. If you're trying to be like, well, I heard on the Jug Life podcast that depth jumps can help with my lifting, so I'm going to do them for, 6 months, 6 months straight, you're fucked. So very powerful effect, but a small dose. So definitely keep that in mind. But Joel, where can they find you and follow you, learn more from you?
Yeah, so if you want to look at like Instagram or any social media, just Fly Sports on Twitter, Instagram, those types of things, as well as my website, which is www.justflysports.com, where I run a blog and then a podcast as well on a lot of sports performance topics. A lot of the coaches I referenced, I interviewed there. It's been a huge learning process for me.
So. What's the name of the podcast?
Oh, Just Fly Performance Podcast.
All right,
cool.
Yeah. Good branding. Very he cool. does a he keeps it all together.
Same thing.
You can find me on Instagram, max_Ada, or on Facebook, or you can email me, max@jtsstrength.com.
And if you enjoy the Jug Life podcast, go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review, write us something funny or nice. It's going to help more people find this and hopefully learn how to reach their goals a little bit better. Interested in coaching for powerlifting, weightlifting, strongman, super total, or power building, visit juggernautcoaching.com. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. 3 videos a week, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, brought to you by the world's strongest videographer, Shorty Sedang. And I'm Chad Wesley Smith, @ChadWesleySmith and @JuggernautTraining on Facebook and Instagram. Filling up your newsfeed all day. This was the Jug Life Podcast. Thanks for watching or listening. We'll see you next week.